And at some level, we had convinced ourselves that for objects with charge Q, mass M, doesn't sound good, was not broken though. The Dirac equation was gamma A PA, I don't want to write it like that, del A plus IQ AA plus M acting on this four-dimensional wave function is equal to zero. Now, we ended up last time by making some comments about gauge transformations. And I said I'd describe what the Aharonov-Bohm effect was, so now is the time to do that. I guess Aharonov will be here sometime late next month. And he's always worth listening to, so go to his colloquium. Next week. Next week could be next month, but isn't. Monday, okay. A pity I know to miss him. So he and Bohm invented a very simple experiment to discover whether or not the wave functions behave in exactly the way they're supposed to. What I'm going to say works for anything. It doesn't have to be just Dirac particles. The idea is very simple. Imagine that you have a long solenoid that is located perpendicular to this board. So a section through it would look something like this. So inside this solenoid, there is some huge B field, and outside it, you want to arrange the magnetic field to be strictly zero. So you can do that by sort of shielding the thing that looks something like that. So in any region exterior to here, there is no electromagnetic field. The idea is very simple, that you have a coherent source of electrons over here. And you have over here, or at least along this direction, a way of detecting the electron density. Now, what will happen if you set this up properly? Is that if you end up over here, then you can imagine the electrons going this way, or you can imagine them going this way. And as you move in that direction or that direction, you'll see some interference pattern. If you think waves instead of particles, it might be easier. So an interference pattern will be generated on this screen up here. Now, how do you actually see anything with this setup? There is some B field in there, but out here, B is equal to zero. And let's remind you that B must be equal to curl of A. So if you are in a region of space where B is equal to zero, then locally, at any rate, A must be of the form grad something, which I will call lambda. In other words, it's pure gauge. Now, let's contemplate looking at what happens if you try to construct these interference fringes up here. What is the wave function? In the absence of any electromagnetic field anywhere, Let's just suppose that the wave function is psi of x. We don't care what psi of x is. Now, what happens is, suppose that A is no longer equal to 0. But is of the form grad lambda. So this means that the spatial bit AI will be equal to DI of lambda and A0 will be equal to 0. Then we know that psi of x, the new psi, psi in the presence of charges, sorry, with a field, with A, must be equal to psi of x, the original one, times e to the I q lambda, and a minus sign. That's what we saw before. Now, what is... Now, suppose that you start here. What you will see here is governed by the phase change along this path relative to this path. So, here's a point A, here's a point B. This would be path X, and this is path Y. You're interested in finding the difference in phase between A, X, B, and A, Y, B. So if you went along this path from A to B via X, the phase change will be just relative to the original one, is the integral of lambda along that path from 0 to, I should say it's the integral of grad lambda along that path. Let's write it that way. A to B via x. Similarly, if you're interested in the phase change between here and here, it's going to be the integral from A to B via y of grad lambda dot dl. This is via x. This is via y. So the difference between the two, you can summarize in the following way. So this is the total phase change. This is equal to lambda of B minus lambda of A via Y. So the difference between the two is the integral around the closed loop of grad lambda. So it's just the difference between the two. In other words, it's the integral of A to X to B minus B A to Y to B, which is the same thing as the integral from A to X to B to Y to A. So that's going to be the phase difference between the two paths. So where anything, well, let's leave it like that. What is grad lambda? Well, grad lambda is just a dot dl. But by Stokes' theorem, this is the same thing as the integral of b over a surface bounded by this line. So this is equal to the integral of b over this entire surface. In other words, it's the flux. So what you have learned from this is that just because there is some flux through this region, you cannot, although you can put b equal to 0 out here, you can't regard a as being 0 in this region just because b is 0. So a is not equal to 0 out here, because we've seen it's got to be equal to the integral around a closed loop has got to be equal to the flux through it. So what does that mean in practice? Let's think about what happens to the difference in phases between this path and this path. So the actual physical difference in phase is going to be e to the minus iq lambda along one path, that's one along one path, I just call that delta lambda between a, I'm not explaining it very well. The difference between the phase here and the phase here along this path is just going to be q times integral a x b of grad lambda dot dl, which is q of lambda at b minus q of lambda at a, which does depend on the path, because this is via x. Along the other path, it will be the integral of a y b times the charge, which is q lambda of b computed via y minus lambda at a, which is of course fixed. So the difference of these two is going to be q times the flux. So, if you sit here, the electrons will only see zero field, but by changing the flux through here, you can change the relative phases along these two paths. So you could, for example, crank up the flux and turn constructive interference into destructive interference. That means that the interference pattern will change as B changes, even though none of these paths, either classically or quantum mechanically, will see any magnetic field. So if you think about this, this is quite miraculous. It says, there is no field. What you're doing is by changing the flux through here, which changes nothing outside, you change this interference pattern that you see up here. That's because the phase of the wave function is affected by the potential and not by the field strength. So you can do this experiment, and you'll discover the experiment works. So experimentally, this has been verified and proves that quantum mechanically, particles coupled to the vector potential by the potential, not the field. If someone had told you that in 1900, before the advent of quantum mechanics, you would have been amazed. It's not something that you would have expected. So this way in which gauge fields couple to potentials is, again, one of these universal things. For this particular case, it's kind of easy to see. But in general, it's not so easy to see. What was the question? It does not depend on the gauge you choose, because, as we have seen, it was, wherever it's gone somewhere, it was the integral of A around a closed loop, which looks gauge dependent. That was equal to grad of lambda around the closed loop, which, if you like, you can think of as being lambda at 2 pi minus lambda at 0. So it's a change in the lambda. But that, we know from Stokes' theorem, is equal to the integral b dot ds. So this is gauge invariant. So that is gauge invariant.
Why does it need a huge B field to be seen, though? Because
you could do it with you have a small B field, but it's harder to see. The point about a solenoid is that you see you concentrate the magnetic field inside the core of the solenoid,
right,
and it's zero, and it's huge, and it's zero outside. That's really the point.
Sorry,
yeah.
I don't understand why lambda 2 pi and lambda 0.
Would you make it easier if I said that it was lambda of... I mean, the point is that you're asking how does a phase change as you go around a closed path? So you go that way, and I said that was naught, and you get to pi up here, and you get to 2 pi if you come back that way. But if you would like me to write this as lambda of pi along... going computed along one path minus pi along the other path, would that make you happier?
So is that referring to the same, the values at the B screen? Or
the yeah, the point is that you see, if you compute what the phase does as you go from here to here along this path, you get something. You go from here to here along this path, you get something else.
So is lambda not just the value of the thing that you are deriving
it
from? Is it the value of some integral?
It's the value of b dot ds. Well, the difference is the value of b dot ds. The absolute value of lambda anywhere you like is something which is arbitrary. You can't fix it absolutely, but you can detect differences. Yes.
I think that the point of confusion is that you use lambda even for general A, which is not only for. Like you don't have any lambda which covers the whole space.
Ah, no.
And yes, then you.
I deliberately didn't want to put it that way. For those who have seen the mathematical trick involved in this, when you compute A equals grad lambda, then there will be a unique lambda provided that the domain in which we're trying to find the lambda is simply connected. This domain is not simply connected because you can catch this thing with a piece of string which tells you that something funny going on. So there's a topological obstruction to finding, given A, finding lambda. So that's what's gone wrong. But I didn't want to do it that way because that would require us to get into a kind of horrible discussion about, cohomology and so forth. Yes?
So let me know the change in interference pattern isn't just due to the fact that the electrons scattering off the solenoid.
If you have here something which isolates the magnetic field, you know, like a new metal screen or something, then you can be certain that the magnetic field outside here is zero, and the electrons don't get inside. In the absence of any B field in the middle, you can measure what the interference pattern up here is. Now, what you do then is you change the magnetic field inside here. That doesn't change anything outside as far as electrons scattering off this thing, but you will observe a change in the interference pattern. So that's how you can be certain of that.
Yeah, but there could be some tunneling through this, and when you turn on the B field.
Oh, well, these are kind of experimental details that I don't like to get into because I'm not an experimenter. But you know there's this danger. So if you were going to design this experiment to convince a skeptic, you would do everything within your power to make sure that the shield was perfect and nothing was going to tunnel inside, some huge thing, and you know, the effects would be tiny. Yes.
If you did this on astronomical scale, so you put everything big and then you vary B while the electrons are kind of mid-travel, what goes on?
Astronomical scale.
Well, I mean, if everything is large enough that the speed of light actually isn't infinite, basically, so that you can vary B between, you know, while the electron is in motion.
Oh, some time dependent thing.
Yeah. But it'd be easier to see if something is, you know,
is
gigantic.
I assumed that everything was static in this particular analysis. If everything was time dependent, then the first bad thing that would happen to you is that you'd have to change this to psi of x and t. And then we'd have to start worrying. Well, I think that this would still work, actually.
I mean,
this would still work. So you could undoubtedly get some kind of movie, I suppose. But I think it would change very much.
But at what? Would there be a delay?
Oh, there'd be a rather time delay.
I mean, the delay will be the speed of light, but will it be higher than that by whatever?
Oh, you mean, can you invent something with causality violating?
Well, no, not like I can say we can't. But will the moment at which your interference pattern change be larger than the time it takes for light to travel from the B field to the screen? I can't quite figure out at what point the interference pattern will change.
I see what you mean. You mean, suppose that this was, what you're asking is, suppose this was a time-dependent field, when would you see the time dependence up here?
Yeah. Or make it, like a step function kind of.
Right. But it's basically you're asking about the time delay of signals between here and here. Well, my guess is it would correspond to the average speed of the electrons as they're going from here to here.
Well,
But I agree that there is a potential problem, because you might have thought it was the time scale was governed by this distance from there to there, actually. I'm not sure you can work it out. I think you know enough to work it out. Because I don't think you need anything other than what's here to do it. Don't think I want to do it.
Okay.
There was a question in the corner by the window.
Oh, I was going to say, if you variable the magnetic field, you get an electric field, and then this is kind of...
Do it slowly. It doesn't matter. See, if you've got a time-dependent magnetic field in here, then of course you'll have an electric field in here. But you won't have an electric field outside.
You can shield it.
If you screen it properly.
If you use a power shielding,
yeah. Yeah. Well, of course, we assume that you do that. I mean, I assume that the experimenters did that, but I don't know for a fact. I trust them. Yeah.
Even if you have a perfect metal shielding, the electric field inside will induce a charge on the surface of the metal. And even if you have shielding, there will be an electric field outside, because shielding doesn't change the fact that, given a loop, there's a changing magnetic field inside
yes,
it.
Yes, all right, that's true. But whatever you do, if you wait long enough, you will end up in a static situation, and you will know that there has been a change between your initial static situation and your final static situation.
So, maybe I'm not understanding how this works. The effect occurs because the sheet, like, you draw this plane between, like, along your, like, this sheet covering the path. Like,
yes.
Sorry, the path is the boundary of the sheet. You run the sheet through the solenoid,
mm-hmm.
and because the sheet runs through the solenoid, that's why you have a phase shift.
That's right.
But you can draw the sheet anywhere, right?
Yes.
So why not, like... You know, so somebody has like a solenoid in the Andromeda galaxy because they were doing this experiment, and you can draw your sheet. I guess you already have the answer.
Yeah, no magnetic monopole. So the flux
right.
through any surface is bounded by the same boundary is the same.
Bounded by
the divergence of B is zero. So the integral of the flux through a closed surface will be zero.
Your question is about a closed
wrong.
Universe, isn't it?
What?
Your question is about a closed universe?
No. I'm
no.
saying, like, look, okay, somebody in the galaxy is, like, doing this experiment, so they have, like, a solenoid.
Right.
And so I'm not doing this experiment. I'm just shooting electrons, like, next to each other. But can't I... So I have my electron path here, and can't I just draw my surface so it goes through the solenoid in the Andromeda galaxy?
So here is my solenoid, and here is space, and here is the Andromeda galaxy. And you're saying, I'm going to perform the experiment in this region, so why don't I consider this surface as opposed to that surface? Is that the question?
Sure.
Let's draw the lines at B. In this picture, I have specifically excluded the possibility that any of the lines of B come back and intersect here. So I have deliberately restricted B to be zero inside some region which I will draw in purple, because there only seems to be purple. Oh, brown. So B is zero inside that region, and it's this region here, inside here, that I perform the experiment in. So that means the lines of B will come out here, and whatever they do, they won't intersect this brown region.
Ah. Okay.
Does that answer the question?
Yeah, so for the Aronoff-Wilm effect to work, you have to, how do I say this? Your pass has to like pass through a loop of magnetic pipeline in some sense?
Yeah, it's got to be inside here.
Okay.
It was outside here.
Right.
No interesting effect.
Okay.
I mean, you could argue the solenoid picture is some kind of idealization, which is true. Okay. You didn't really need the Dirac equation to do that. But it's easier if you do. Now, what I wanted to do next, if I can find what I was trying to do, was to look at the Dirac equation in a general electromagnetic field. So I want to look at gamma A dA plus IQAA plus M acting on psi equals zero for some generic field A. So we want to write out what this equation tells us. And I'm going to look specifically at the non-relativistic limit of this equation now. So we need a dictionary. The dictionary is that gamma A is I 0, 0 minus I with an implicit 2 by 2 unit matrices in there, gamma 0. That gamma I was 0, sigma I 0. We remember that A, as a 4 vector with its index upstairs, was the electrostatic potential, and then the vector potential A. So we now need to decompose this thing into its two components, really two. What do I call that? Chi and capital and big phi. Not to be confused with that phi, I'll try to write it like that as a capital phi. So let's look at the entire Dirac equation. Now, we did this before, but now we're going to get something a bit more complicated. First of all, you sum over all of these things, so you get a 0 and a 0. So I'm going to get an I d by dt in the top left-hand corner, a minus I d by dt in the bottom right-hand corner from gamma 0 with that. Then there's a gamma I di over space, which gives me a sigma dot grad term here and a sigma dot grad term here. Now we've got to do these terms involving the electromagnetic potential. There's a gamma 0 A 0, so that's going to give me a plus I times IQ times A 0 with its index downstairs, which is minus phi, remember that A0, A with its index downstairs, will be minus phi vector A. So you get I squared and a minus sign, which gives me a plus Q phi. And I would like to erase that and call that plus Q phi, rather than writing it in that messy form. Then down here, well, the only difference is the minus sign in front of the whole thing, so I get minus q phi. Then there are the spatial components of this thing, which is going to give me I q sigma dot A. Then lastly, this is M along the diagonals, and that acts on chi and phi and gives zero. So as before, we get two coupled differential equations for the two pairs of components of the wave function. So let's look at those equations explicitly. I d by dt plus q phi plus m acting on chi plus sigma dot del plus I q sigma. I don't want to write it like that. Let me write it differently. Sigma dotted into del plus I q a acting on chi, phi is equal to 0. So that's one of them. And the other one is sigma dot del plus I q a acting on chi plus minus I d by dt minus q phi plus m acting on phi equals 0. So those are two bits of the Dirac equation when coupled to an arbitrary electromagnetic field. Now I want to look non-relativistically. So that means that Q and A are both going to be small. Phi and A are both small. And the total energy minus the rest mass divided by the rest mass is going to be very much less than 1. That means that since I d by dt is equal to the energy operator, this thing is going to be approximately E. I have suddenly become worried about the sign of something. No, I think that's right. M chi. Can anyone see if I've made some kind of sign mistake somewhere?
I think that your first equation is not coherent with what you said last time.
Good.
Minus IQA.
Minus IQA. That's not what's bothering me. You might be right about that, actually. The substitution that you want to make is P goes to P minus QA. So this is minus I grad goes to minus I grad minus QA. Multiply by I gives me del goes to del minus IQA. I know what the problem is. Right. The problem is slightly more subtle than I had. So you say that I should have got that. I think so. You might be right. What did I do? P goes to multiply by minus I. I should have multiplied by minus I. Now that's right. So this one, I multiply by I and get that. All right, I agree with that. Let's change this to a minus sign. Right. Which means that we should change this to a minus sign. Right. The problem had to do with the up and down indices, which is why I became confused. The momentum with an index upstairs, PA, is equal to E vector P. But with a downstairs index is, of course, minus E P. We said that PA goes to a minus I del A. So that means that minus the energy is equal to minus I d by dt in this way of doing things, which is a bit perverse. So this thing should be minus E when acting in this relativistic situation. Now I understand what the confusion is. That's a little bit backwards to what one usually has, I guess. So that means that if you stare at this equation, I d by dt is minus E. So here you get a minus E minus q phi plus m. And so this expression here just collapses down to a non-relativistic momentum squared over 2m minus q phi, which we know to be small compared to m. That means that if chi is of order 1, phi is small. And that is the essence of the non-relativistic approximation. So with that in mind, we want to try to simplify these two equations in a way which works only in the non-relativistic limit. So this thing is dominated essentially by the rest mass. And so phi is small. So down here we get, I'll just write it down. Here you see this thing is minus, is plus the energy. So here we can just replace this thing by 2m. And it will make is approximately the same thing as this. So The second equation minus I d by dt plus q phi plus m is approximately the same thing as 2m, because this is the energy. It's roughly speaking the mass together with some non-relativistic corrections. So they are going to be small, so you can replace this thing by 2m, giving sigma dot grad minus IQA acting on chi plus 2m times phi equals 0. This means that whenever you see phi, you can replace it by this. That means that you can substitute that expression into here and get a nice-ish looking equation. I d by dt minus q phi plus m acting on chi plus sigma dot del minus IQA acting on phi, which we have decided is equal to sigma dot grad minus IQA divided by 2m times chi with a minus sign is equal to 0. So we have that equation, which, as you now see, looks awfully Schrodinger-like. There is an I d by dt here, and there is going to be a del squared coming from this over 2m with a minus sign. So that looks awfully like what you would expect from something which is the Schrodinger equation. But with some exceptions, because these are sigma matrices sitting here. And I underlined those to indicate that those were three vector type things. I still have the feeling that I have a sign problem somewhere. I d by dt acting on chi. Let's not write it like that. I d by dt minus q phi plus m acting on chi minus 1 over 2m. And the easy way to do this is to write this out using suffix notation everywhere. It's sigma I, sigma j. And then you get del minus IQA, so it's di minus IQAI, dj minus IQAJ, acting on chi equals 0. Remember, this di is an operator which acts on everything to its right. So if we collect up all the terms in here, there is di dj acting on chi. So it's that, that, and that. Then there's a minus iqai dj acting on chi. That's that one and that one. Then there's going to be a minus iq di acting on this, and I get two terms out of this. I'm going to get a diaj times chi. Then I'm going to get a minus IQ. So here I've differentiated the A, then there'll be another term in which I differentiate the chi. So there'll be an AJDI of chi. And lastly, there's a minus Q squared AIAJ acting on chi. And that's supposed to be equal to zero. Now I know a general formula for multiplying two sigma matrices. Sigma I, sigma j is delta ij plus I epsilon ijk times sigma k. This bit is symmetric under the interchange of I and j. This one is anti-symmetric under the interchange of I and j. This term here is symmetric under the interchange of I and j. Symmetric when you've got these two bits which are both symmetric. So let's rewrite that in the various bits that we have. Let's deal with the symmetric part first. Delta ij di dj. Then these two things come together, so we can call this minus 2i q a I dj chi. This term has got a symmetric bit. This term is symmetric. The only bit that has an anti-symmetric part is in here, which is going to give us a plus 1 over 2m sigma I sigma j I epsilon I j. Oh dear. I'm trying to do two things at once. Sigma I sigma j anti-symmetric part. Sigma k. So that's the anti-symmetric part of this. And the only thing that's anti-symmetric is in here, where we get I. There's another I here. I times Q. DIAJ, but I can replace that by 1/2 of DIAJ minus DJAI. Acting on chi equals zero. Let's try and collect up all these terms. You get I d by dt minus m acting on chi minus 1 over 2m into delta ij di dj is del squared. Here we get two terms of the same, minus 2i q a dot grad chi. Sorry? Can't hear you.
Q5.
Oh, we've got that back. Somehow I wasn't thinking about that bit. A dot grad acting on chi. This term here I can turn it into div of A. The divergence of the vector field A. Minus Q squared A squared. Chi. And then there's an interesting term, which is this term. I've got an I there and an I there, so that combines and gives me a minus Q over 4m epsilon ijk F I J, because this combination of stuff is just the electromagnetic field strength tensor times sigma k acting on chi equals zero. Let's concentrate a little bit on trying to make sense of this thing. Fij, spatial components of the field strength tensor, is just epsilon ijl times the magnetic field. So this term here is minus q over 4m epsilon ijk epsilon ijl sigma k bl acting on chi. So that's the whole term. Epsilon ijk, epsilon ijl is 2 delta kl. So this thing is equal to minus q over 2m. This is now sigma k bl delta kl, so it's just sigma dot b acting on chi. So the whole expression becomes I d by dt plus m minus q phi and an I is it really an I here? I don't think there's any I there at all. No I. Minus 1 over 2 m del squared chi minus 2iqa dot grad chi. Then there's this term here. I can forget this term because I can always put it equal to zero by an appropriate gauge transformation. That means that I have to not be careful not to change the phase of the wave function by any further processes. Minus q over 2m sigma dot b acting on chi equals zero. Many of these terms we recognize. Energy and the rest mass is equal to, so this is basically the kinetic energy here. This is the potential energy due to an electrostatic potential. Let's call it electrostatic potential, electric potential. This term here is the usual kinetic energy operator. This term is what gives rise to the Lorentz force law. And I guess there will be more about that later on. Someone was going to do that, I guess, this afternoon. This is a quadratic term and is not very interesting. This term, however, is absolutely vital. If you think about this, this term is what you'd expect from a coupling of the spin to the magnetic field, which is what you'd expect a magnetic dipole moment. So this term you want to interpret as magnetic dipole moment dotted with B. what is the value of the magnetic dipole moment? It's Q over 2m times sigma. That's the magnetic dipole moment. That is equal to Q over m times the spin, because the spin is a half sigma. So what you see is that this corresponds to a magnetic dipole moment, but the G factor is equal to 2. Which I guess you know experimentally is what you expect for electrons. So this you can regard as the first triumph of the Dirac equation. It explicitly shows, I guess it didn't predict because it was discovered afterwards, that the magnetic field couples to spin in a particular way with a G factor of 2. So the triumph is that that was known to be phenomenologically true, but could have been absolutely anything. What you see from this is that it is an inevitable fact of life. You're stuck with it. You end up with a factor of 2, G factor of 2, whether you like it or not, and the magnetic field couples to spin in precisely the way that had been measured. So this really was the thing which convinced everybody that the Dirac equation is the right kind of thing. Yes? The qualitative explanation of what the G factor is the following. Suppose, for example, you had a charge moving in a circle, like this, give you a little current, as you expect for orbital angular momentum. That gives rise, charge moving in a circle gives rise to a magnetic dipole moment. You can think of it as current if you like. And if you calculate the ratio of the angular momentum to the magnetic dipole moment, you end up with Q over 2m. In these units. Other way up. 2m over q. It's usually written the other way up. This is referred to as having, so this is essentially called the Bohr magnetron. Well, it would be if it was the other way up. This corresponds to a G factor of 1. What happens here? The ratio of the angular momentum to the magnetic dipole moment is Q over M. I'm sorry. It might be better if I actually just turn this up, then I don't get confused. So here you get Q over 2m for just orbital angular momentum. For the Dirac particle, this ratio is Q over m, what you see from staring at this thing. So this is referred to as having a G factor of 2. And prior to the Dirac equation being found, this was a mysterious thing that you added in by hand to explain the spectrum of hydrogen in a detailed way, but seemed completely and utterly ad hoc. Whereas what you discover from doing the Dirac theory is that it was predicted all, well, you should have been able to predict it all along. You automatically get a G factor of 2. So this is a great triumph. And of course, it explains where the spin has come from. And explains spin. So that really was what made everyone believe in the Dirac equation. Now, of course, something in all of this makes you not believe in the Dirac equation. It made Dirac not believe in the Dirac equation. Until he came to his senses. The wave function is the form chi and phi. And non-relativistically, we found that chi was more important than phi, because we insisted on having things of a particular sign. And you could, if you wanted to, eliminate phi. And this experimentally was discovered to describe electrons. But there is absolutely nothing in anything I've done that told me that I should do that. This is some non-relativistic artifice. And as far as the relativistic formulation is concerned, phi and chi are on equal footings. And therefore, by a judicious choice of limits, it ought to be possible to find a situation in which phi is very much bigger than chi in some different non-relativistic limit. And it is distinct from this. So you might ask yourself, what is this? This different non-relativistic limit describes antiparticles, namely the antiparticle of the electron, the positron. Now, if you think about that, that was an amazing theoretical prediction. There was absolutely no reason to expect such a thing. And indeed, when Dirac used the Dirac equation to make this prediction, he was generally thought to be a bit crazy. In 1933, positrons were discovered, which is an absolute vindication of mathematics over reality, I suppose. My guess is that David Tong will tell you much more about positrons than I'm going to, so I guess we should stop there. So, thank you. Now, at 2 o'clock this afternoon, I will make an attempt to explain what the black hole information paradox is about. So there's a request to explain some of what my research is about. That's part of it. So I will do that then. And hopefully I'll finish before 3:30 when wine and cheese starts.